Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Good day. You are listening to America This Week. I am Carrie Weber, executive editor at America Magazine.
Hey, I'm Tim Reedy, also executive editor, sitting in for Father Matt Malone.
And each week we offer you the news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world gathered by our team at America. And we have one of our team members here today, Zach Davis.
Happy to be with you.
We are happy to have you. And our guest today has a little bit to say about how young people have been receiving the church's message lately, which I think is a big part of it. She, as a teacher and as an employee at a place that is producing a great study about this, she will be giving us a little bit of insight onto that. So we have Ellen Koenig. She has a Master of Arts in Religion from Yale Divinity School. She previously worked at Commonweal Magazine in New York City and taught in the Catholic Studies program at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And she recently moved back to her native home of Minnesota and now works at Anselm Academic, which is a publisher of college-level theology and religious studies books. And they just released the study...
Going, Gone.
Well, actually, it's not the Anselm Academic. It's St. Mary's Press, which is the parent company. Going, Gone, which they did in partnership with CARA, which is a two-year qualitative study on the dynamics of disaffiliation in young Catholics. So, and she herself is a young Catholic.
Yes.
So, Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're really glad to have you. So one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you today is because you have some experience in the classroom with young people, and you have an article on our website called How Modern Technology Helped Me Teach Theology to Uninterested College Students. And you can find that at americamagazine.org/SiriusXM. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the story that you tell in this piece.
Definitely. So the story that I tell in this piece actually... true to millennial form, started as a tweet thread that I was so excited about what happened. I needed to share it. But I was teaching Augustine, who is one of my very favorites, and I was having a really hard time getting my students to wrestle. They're sophomores, 19, 20-year-olds, sophomores in college, getting them to really take on the questions that Augustine was taking on. And what I found was falling short in the experience for them, or what I wasn't able to communicate just by having them read the text, was that they weren't relating to why the questions were mattering to him, like why he was feeling plagued by, in particular, the example I use in this essay is plagued by trying to imagine God and not being able to fit God into his imagination. And so I started desperately thinking of ways to ask questions that would prompt them to think through that question, to feel the weight of that question, but in a modern way. And in the essay, you know, spoiler alert, I use the internet. The internet becomes this metaphor in the classroom for me.
Right. You mean it as a metaphor, not just like Googling an answer of how to get them to pay attention.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a helpful distinction. Yeah. We did not Google the answer to Augustine's concern about immateriality. That would have been great.
And you didn't Google how to teach. Either. Right.
I didn't. I have Googled that before, but that was not what happened in this case. No, we started thinking about how hard it is to picture the internet without picturing laptops or cell phones, which are just devices that use the internet. And that became a really robust way of starting the conversation about how difficult it must be then to think about God in the imagination. If we can't even picture the internet, how in the world do we picture God?
In some context, so you were teaching at a Catholic school, but, yes. You know, maybe not everyone in the class is Catholic, or were they required to take your class?
They were. So there was probably, that was part of why I think there's a little bit of an uphill battle sometimes with required courses at Catholic universities that the students didn't opt into it. And so you're making a case really regularly for why these questions matter in the first place, why these texts matter in the first place.
But I think that's an experience common not just to Catholic universities, but to, you know, CCD teachers. It's not like, or religious ed teachers or Catholic school teachers. It's not like the, you know, kids are there of their own volition totally, right?
Yeah, Yep. I think that's exactly right. And so trying to make it relevant for them becomes not just like, let's make it cool and like introduce guitars or something, but actually finding ways
that didn't work. We tried that.
It turns out I didn't try guitars in the classroom. Fortunately, I didn't come to that. The experience itself has to connect with what's relevant to them, not just what we presume is relevant to them, but actually using images and concrete examples from their world. I'm saying their world, but also I'm not much older than them, which is, I think, part of the reason that I care very deeply about this.
You're right. It's interesting you point out that part of the challenge was that they have a certain level of comfort with this sort of sense of a spiritual realm. That you write, God is spiritual, so is grandma, and so is my yoga practice. Easy. You know, so it's all kind of grouped together in there. And for you to have to kind of pull out this particular part of that and to separate it a little bit from a vague sense of what is spiritual must have been a challenge.
Yeah, and I think that I think this is an issue that's not just taking place in the classroom, like Zach pointed out, but I think we have a lot of religious language that gets thrown around without really understanding where that language came from, who we're inheriting in terms of the thought process, the tradition of thinking behind some of these weighty terms. And spirituality is definitely one of them. It's a word that needs unpacking, but we use it so casually in culture mm-hmm. for a variety of things that we sort of have to either reclaim language or start to find new ways, again, like metaphors or you know, there are tons of different examples, but we have to figure out new ways of saying things relevantly that doesn't rely on kind of trite or common language.
I'm reminded Father Sam Sawyer, who was sometimes host here, shared a story. He was also teaching Augustine, and I guess it was the first book where he's talking about, you know, our hearts are restless until they find a place. And you, I may have the quote off there a little bit, mm-hmm. and you, oh God, but he got a sense. I think he actually asked for people's hands to say, you know, how many of you do feel restless? And it was only like a third of the people put their hands up. So he's like, if you're 19 years old and you don't feel somewhat restless, what's wrong? Or are we starting, do we have to start earlier? Do we have to like kind of, does the conversation have to predate what even that means? You know, so I think it relates to your question of like, what does this language mean and how do they understand it?
Yeah, that's a great example.
Well, and something that you point out is that it's not just like making the answers matter or different or relevant, but it's sort of about, how do we ask these questions? You have this great line in your conclusion, Mert. Theology is impotent and irrelevant when simply presented as a set of ideas, doctrines, or conclusions to be passively internalized. Tell me, when did you feel like you learned that you know, you started to own your own questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can actually point to a time. Like, I remember being in elementary school and starting to have questions that now I look back and see them as religious and existential kinds of questions about, actually the real story is we were doing The Wizard of Oz for a school production, and it started to give me nightmares about like waking up to a new reality that wasn't the one I believed I was already in. And I started asking those questions and remember feeling really discouraged about finding answers or not necessarily realizing church was a place that those questions were contained and where mystery was contained, where there was safety in those questions and space for them. And so trying to think through theological questions has basically just been a lifelong project for me now. It's something I just love to do because eventually I did start reading. I had catechists and teachers and professors who encouraged me, and parents who encouraged me. I think that's kind of rare, to be honest, but I think a lot of people have these questions and don't necessarily know to articulate them or know where the safe space is to ask them.
Yeah, because you point out that might, you know, to a child or an adolescent, that they might not think, oh, the church is where I should go to ask this question.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They might go to their public school teacher or their friends or the more likely the internet.
The internet.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating because I was having this conversation with my mom recently, is that we know a lot of people who struggle with a lot of questions that the church has some good answers for, but that there's a kind of resistance to finding them in the church, that people feel like they have to kind of start this process on their own without sort of 2,000 years of history and theology and other people thinking about this. And I think one of the nice things about having the church is you still get to answer these questions on your own. You still get to do that, but you're not alone in that struggle. You understand, okay, people have thought about this before, and what have they had to say about it? And, you know, as you were saying, Tim, you have, like, it starts with the question of things, you know, like you're saying, who here is restless? But you have to know to ask that, right? You have to just know that that's even a thing you can feel, or that somebody hundreds of years earlier felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Do you find any resistance to finding these answers in the church did you find that among your students?
You know what? I don't even think that I could call it resistance, because that would make it so that there was more agency than I was necessarily perceiving. Like, I think a lot of young people don't even know that the church has this tradition and this wealth, this intellectual community of question askers, because their experience just on the parish level or in the parochial school level isn't demonstrating that. It doesn't occur to them. So the resistance, if there is any, is very passive. But I think instead I would maybe say they're surprised. That was one of the things I loved about teaching, is getting to surprise students with the fact that Catholicism really has something to say about this or that, or that somebody actually felt what you felt, but to, like, you know, 1350 years ago. So, like, this idea that there's a tradition of asking questions, and Carrie, like you were saying, you're not alone in them, is really reassuring, but I'm not sure that that's well advertised, to be honest.
I was going to say, there's a cynical view you can take of this if you're part of the church. That's, you know, woe to this new generation that's apathetic and doesn't care and is more concerned about Twitter and Tinder and Snapchat. Or there's an alternative view, right?
Which is
like, so this is a problem for the church, right?
Are you giving it to us?
Yeah.
Or
well,
are you,
I think Ellen.
This is a question we all have to answer. With 2,000 years of history behind us.
Right. Well, as Ellen said, it's not well advertised, right? So this is primarily, I think, a problem. It's the church's problem.
It's a matter of evangelization.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being more clear about what that is and what it means. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. Another perennial question. We may or may not have the answer for this by the end of the show. Zach, we're relying on you.
How much time do I have? I'm kidding.
We're joined by Ellen Koenig, who has been speaking about an article she wrote for us about teaching theology to college students. And we're going to transition to some work that her new institution, St. Mary's Press, has done, and specifically a survey of young people and these questions of engagement with the church. Maybe you can introduce it for our listeners, Ellen.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So St. Mary's Press, which is the parent company of Anselm Academic, the press for which I work, commissioned a study with CARA about 2 years ago, and it was just released a couple of weeks ago. And the study is called Going, Going, Gone, The Dynamics of Disaffiliation in Young Catholics. Really, it's the first of its kind, because it takes some of the Pew Religious Landscape or PRRI data about the increasing trend toward nuns, N-O-N-E-S, and religious disaffiliation in a statistical way, and it adds qualitative data to that research. So it's interviews with young people between the ages of 15 and 25 who no longer identify as Catholic.
But once did. So it's a really interesting group of people, because they're the people that we speculate about a lot, right? Like, well, this is why so-and-so left the church, or I know so this young person and he got bored or whatnot, you know, but this is actual real data on why people no longer affiliate with the church, and at a very early age, relatively speaking.
Yeah. So the study found that the average range for disaffiliation was between the ages of 10 and 20, but the actual median age, the average age is 13. And that doesn't necessarily mean they you know, 13-year-olds can abruptly stop going to church, you know, if their parents are still driving them there on Sunday mornings. But it does mean that some shift takes place where they're no longer invested in that community, in the system of belief, in the experience of authority, whatever the, there are various reasons for disaffiliation that they name in their own words. But 13 was a surprising number for a lot of us.
So was that, why was that surprising to you?
Well, it was surprising to me because it seems like a serious act of agency at a young age. I think my surprise doesn't come from the fact that young people are asking those kinds of questions at that age. But when I look back at my own 13-year-old life many years ago, I recall having questions of great weight, but I don't recall feeling that I was in a position to desert a tradition that I hadn't taken a lot of time to explore, hadn't thoroughly, investigated before. But that might just be the nature of my personality. So that was one of the reasons it was shocking for me.
It sounds like it's not surprising for you, Zach.
No, not really. I think,
I mean, that's confirmation age, which for the average young Catholic is what sort of when is probably the last touch point for them in terms of affiliation with the church.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the state of religious education is in varying states of quality in different parts of the country. And as Ellen points out, you know, if young people are asking these big questions and they're getting bad answers or told, don't ask this question, or just sort of getting rubber stamped on their way through the sacraments, I mean, to start disaffiliating at that age, I mean, I was 13, I was probably 14 when I got confirmed, and honestly, if someone had not pulled me in to the church, you know, someone invited me to a youth group where, you know, we had adult volunteers who took an interest in my life and my joys and struggles. But here I am at this Catholic media organization, still practicing.
Thank you, that nameless person.
Right. But inertia, I can definitely see a track of my life where inertia would have just led me to disaffiliation.
Well, it's sort of also at that age where it's usually ending eighth grade, starting high school, and you're really, you know, thinking about your identity. Like, who am I, and do I want to start high school as that religious kid in the corner, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, being religious does not relegate you to a corner. But it does mean different things if you're starting in different communities too, in different parts of the country, in Catholic school and public school, where this may or may not be part of the school culture or the town culture or your family culture, and how much you want to make that a part of your own identity is a question I think kids answer, whether they're really deliberately asking them or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the things that I found really interesting about the survey, though, is it said that for a lot of the people that they interviewed, there was a sense, eventually, maybe not at 10 or 13, but of conscious disaffiliation, right? That it wasn't just somebody kind of got lazy and stopped going to Mass and then just was like, I forgot, I don't go to that anymore. Like, there was a deliberate choice being made by young people to either choose a different faith or to be the ever-present term, you know, spiritual but not religious necessarily, to no longer associate with the church, but to still believe in God. Because a lot of the young people still were interested in God and spirituality, but just not in the form that the church was offering or that they perceived the church was offering.
Yeah, that really struck me too. And when I first read the study, that was one of the things that I think most surprised me, was just how thoughtful the departure was. Because I think it's much easier, especially for people who, I'm stealing this term from Zach, are professional Catholics, like people who work in realms where Catholicism and religion are like very easily and readily talked about, where discussions happen, where questions can be asked. Like, people who live in this ministerial or educational or media world, I think there's a temptation to believe that disaffiliation is out of malice for doctrine or out of, the desire to sleep in on Sundays, laziness, you know, stupidity, like somebody who's not interested in asking the hard questions or facing the hard answers. And that's just not true. These are really thoughtful departures. And that's one of the more stunning elements that I think was came out of St. Mary's Press hosted a three-day workshop with church leaders following the release of the study, and that came up over and over again in conversations there. This is really thoughtful. We're not almost not giving credit to people disaffiliating for the serious discernment they're doing, or it seems, you know, that people aren't giving that kind of thought to their exit.
So what were some of the reasons that people disaffiliate? You mentioned, you know, like something like doctrine, like I don't agree with this particular church teaching, and so I leave. Is that one of the big reasons, or what were some of them?
Doctrine's not a huge one, actually, or it's not the one that's the primary reason, though it might contribute. So this study, Going Gone, talked about three factors that can kind of help categorize the various reasons for disaffiliation. And those factors were, they called these categories the injured, the drifter, and the dissenter. So the injured has a negative experience in church. That could be something like going through a painful divorce and not feeling that the community was there to support, or seeing their own parents sort of rejected from church settings, seeing hypocrisy in church leaders, you know, affairs or adultery, things like that, that don't jibe with their experience of the Sunday piety. The drifter is somebody who sort of maybe tries to stay in, has one foot in the door, is never, like Zach said, is never necessarily invited in, isn't known, isn't welcomed back, isn't missed when they're gone. And the dissenter is the third category. That's a more active resistance. And often it's a combination of all three of these things, but one kind of precipitates the next and the next. You know, somebody's injured, they start to kind of fall away, nobody notices, and then that becomes a reason for them to actively kind of determine that they don't believe these things, which becomes dissent.
And family dynamics are huge here. I mean, it's some of the observations here that, like, a lot of parents are saying, well, you can choose your own faith, which something, you know, that seems like a huge decision for a young person to make. And sometimes people within their own family are not choosing to perhaps take part in a life of faith. So the decision to do so therefore becomes something that, you know, it requires a great deal of agency and courage that, you know, maybe is difficult for somebody who's 11 or 12 years old to summon.
When I think a lot of times, you know, I once heard of this, it's difficult for parents to articulate why their own faith is important to them. I once heard of a confirmation director who had parents and students and sponsors at every single session. And one of the first ones they did, he sat parents and their child face to face. And he said, all right, parents, why are you Catholic? Tell your kid you have 5 minutes and don't mess this up. Because if you mess it up, right, like it matters.
No pressure there. Nope.
Right. But,
but yeah, it's a really good conversation to have that people don't necessarily have, and that some people probably feel uncomfortable having, right? Because it's not necessarily easy, or you might think some of your reasons are sort of above what your child can understand at that point, or you consider them more personal. So it's a worthwhile conversation. And I think
even that's generous. I wonder if adults have done that same thinking, then it's not surprising if that can't be articulated in a clear way, that it looks like hypocrisy or like a blind faith. Like it looks more like something to be suspicious of for young people, rather than something that beckons mystery. Like there's a difference between not knowing how to articulate it, which I think is almost a virtue, like that it's so great or that it's larger than language can contain. And I'm not sure that that's always what's going on. I think for a lot of millennials and Gen Xers, like, were raised by a generation of parents who didn't have language to necessarily articulate their Catholic faith, because they were raised by parents, you know, who just prayed, paid, obeyed. So this idea of handing on the faith in a personal way is, I think, kind of new in American Catholicism.
Are there any takeaways from the study of how we might be better at it? How might we be better at handing on the church and its beliefs to our children?
There is not any takeaways explicitly in the study, but the study, again, was released and immediately followed by this workshop with Catholic leaders. to ask that very question. And the tone throughout the study, if you've had a chance to read it, is very much like, what can this teach us about ourselves, about the experience that people are having in church, rather than looking at disaffiliation as a problem that has to be solved by like increasing membership, thinking about sort of what does church look like if we don't just see it as a membership organization, if the church has a ministry to do that's outside the walls of the church at the moment. So that there's so much to say. There aren't any immediate fixes, though. That becomes clear in the study because of the various dynamics at work in a person's decision to leave.
Right. It's not just like, well, if your parish had better music, you'd be on the road to success.
Right.
Like you pointed out, we've tried.
Right, right. Yeah, it's complicated, as sort of as we were saying before, that there are that these are the questions, like, you know, it seems like some of these young people are asking the questions that some of the young people that you were teaching were struggling to ask. And so trying to find a way to get people to ask these questions and then find those answers in the church, I imagine, is the direction we want to head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And trying to accompany those questions, I think, rather than meet them with suspicion or correlate them too closely with doubt, rather than seeing them as a real curiosity about God and mystery and, you know, religion, ritual, community, meaning making. I think the posture can be really welcoming about these things. And for a long time, for a lot of people, that experience of asking questions has been met with suspicion.
Right. Suspicion or like cookie cutter answers. There's like a movement of apologetics in the American church, I think, which served an important role, but I think some young people, you know, got met with a lot of those and they didn't really fit the specific need or the specific question.
Well, we're very grateful to you, Ellen Koenig, for answering some of these questions for us and for helping us to prompt hopefully some questions in folks listening. So thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, our listeners, for joining us. We invite you to visit our website, americamagazine.org/SiriusXM, where you can find all the content we discussed today. You can follow us on Facebook and or Twitter, and you can subscribe to America by calling 1-800-627-9533. Thanks again for joining us. For Zach Davis and Tim Reedy, this is Carrie Weber. We hope you have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.